You're listening to OWW Radio,
the official radio show of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com.
All right, so here we are, living it day by day. You are a superstar. Heavy, that's what she used to always say.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of OWW Radio. This is the official radio program of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com. Each week, OWW Radio will bring perspective to the WWE, TNA, and everything else making news in the world of professional wrestling. My name is David, and today I am joined by Len Denton, author of the new book, Grappler, Memoirs of a Masked Madman. Len shares memories of his fascinating career, which saw him wrestle all of the big stars of his era, all part of a journey full of ups and downs, twists and turns that can only happen in professional wrestling. Should be a fun show, and I'm glad you're with me today. Mr. Len Denton, welcome to OWW Radio.
David, thank you, buddy. It's a pleasure to be on the air with you, man. Glad to be here. How you doing?
I'm great, and I wanted to congratulate you on your new book, Grappler, Memoirs of a Masked Madman. I thought it was a great read, and I wanted to ask you, though, why was now the right time for you to write a book?
Well, let's see. I've got like, I broke in 77. How many years is that in the business? I actually, it's a long time, but I just, I don't know. Yeah, tell you what happened. Here's how it came to pass. I went along, you know, through the years and you have all these different stories and all these things and different territories and places that I've been. And I would tell people, you know, the different stories and, that happened to me and other guys in wrestling business. And they say, you know, it's something, Grappler, you tell a good story, you ought to write a book. And so this I heard over and over and over, right? So finally I go, you know, maybe they're right. Maybe I should write this down. Maybe I should write a book. So I tried to get someone. I called colleges, and I did different things. It never did seem to work out. And then I met this fellow named Joe from Channel 12, Fox Channel 12, that's what helping us with we're doing a wrestling show here and filming. And Joe says, you know something, I went to college to be a journalist and that's what I do. So if you want to write a book, I tell you what, I'm ready to do it. And he's a big fan of the Grappler. And so he liked the stories I was telling. So we just happened to meet. It was just a sheer good luck thing, a good faith thing. And we got together and that's how it came to pass, because of dear old Joe, it probably would never happen.
Well, the Joe you're talking about, Joe Vithayathil, is that how you say his last name?
Man, you know what? I've known him for almost 5 years now, and I still can't pronounce it. That's why I call him Joe V.
Joe V.
Even on his show, he has a show on Fox on Channel 12, a morning show that comes on every day, Monday through Friday, and they call him Joe V. They don't say his last name on there either.
Fair enough. By the way, so I got an advanced copy of the book. Has the book been released yet on Amazon or in bookstores?
Yes, sir. It's a bestseller on Amazon. It has been for 3 weeks. Yes, and it's you can get it at the book at grapplerbook.com, and it's easy to order. It's on Kindle as well. But yeah, it's been out for a while now, and I've got some real, real good feedback from it. Thank God for everybody. God bless them. You know, they seem to like it, so I'm happy with that.
Yeah, you and Joe did a great job. It's a very fun read, I thought, throughout your history in professional wrestling. But what are some of the challenges? Once you decided to actually write the book, what are some of the challenges in writing a book like this?
Well, it's when you sit down, you think, okay, I'll just tell these stories and we'll put it together and that'll be it, you know. But you're talking, like I said, I broke in the wrestling business back in 1977. This is 2014. And so you go, okay, Grappler, start telling me, you know, from when you first broke in to now, there's a lot of things that happened in that span of time. And so, and I'm trying to think, and when you do a book like this, when someone reads it, you want it to be authentic. You don't want them to read it and go, you know, he wasn't here at this time. He didn't do this. Just to, you know, because people can track that. I tell you what, Joe did his homework. I mean, I went and I laid out the stories the best I possibly could. And Joe did his homework to make sure when he put in that book, okay, this is the year you were in Louisiana. This is the year you were in Tennessee. This is the year this happened in this place. So he put it all in order and he did all his homework, and it takes a while. It's not like, you know, you just all of a sudden boom, boom, it's there. He put all of it together and did it correctly, and I'm really proud of it. I read it. I just think it's great the way he worked on it. So everyone thinks you just, you know, lay the stories out and write a book, but it don't come along that easy. You got to make sure you got to remember back 30-something years ago and start from there. And it's not as easy as you think.
You make a great point about the need to be accurate on where you were for shows, and because first of all, wrestling fans thrive on that accuracy part that we love the history of this business. But also now with YouTube, WWE Network, all these other avenues to pursue the past of professional wrestling, to look back at matches, to look back at the history, you would be exposed quickly if you were inaccurate, right?
Yes, exactly. It's like there was a match I was doing. In one case, for example, it was in Tennessee, and I said that I went there, and they asked me to take my mask off, and I refused, and I ended up quitting, and I was wrestling. The match was, now, in my mind, because at that time, I remember doing an angle, excuse me, some matches with, it was with Macho Man Randy Savage and Jerry Lawler. But at the same time, I had some stuff going on with the Bruise Brothers. And the match that I went there and they asked me, okay, tonight we want you to judge the mask off in Memphis Coliseum. And I refused. I told Eddie Marlin no, and they fired me. And I said, and got my check and I left. But I said it was with Lawler and Savage. And Joe come back and said, hey, Lenny, Grappler, look, you were fixing to wrestle the Bruise Brothers. It wasn't Lawler and Savage. So I had it mistaken, and I'm the one in the match. So stuff like that, you want to get correct because people will call you on it. They'll go, no. What are you talking about? You know, so he did a fantastic job, I thought, of trying to keep everything accurate for the fans, you know, so they could track it, you know?
I mentioned in the opening that throughout your career, boy, you've been in the ring with some of the biggest names this business has ever seen. And we'll touch on a few of them as we go along here. But you grew up in Houston, Texas, correct? And it says in the book that your brothers kind of showed you wrestling on TV, and that's how you got interested in it.
Well, actually, it was not my brother. It was my uncle and my dad. And what it was is my uncle was into going to it, and he come over and he says, hey, I just went to this. Came back from the Sam Houston Coliseum, and you should see these guys. They just beat the hell out of each other. And I was into playing football, you know, like every young man in Texas almost. I was into football and baseball and ran track and was not interested in wrestling whatsoever. But then once my dad got interested in it with my uncle and we started going to the matches, the more that I watched it, the more I liked it. And so I went, and then what really got the thing hooked in me was my dad did construction for a living, right, Dave? And so he got, he met a gentleman named Tiger Conway, which was actually the first black heavyweight Texas champion. And, he was retired at the time, but he had a fence company and he used to put up the steel cages at the matches for when he had a steel cage match. his fence company, he wanted a carport built, and my dad and his crew was building the carport. So we met Tiger Conway, which was an honor. And then I got really close, you know, with him as not real close as a friend, but as meeting him first time a professional wrestler, I was like in awe. And then I got into it a little more, and then they kind of kicked off that way. That's how I really got hooked on and wanting to be a pro wrestler thing from there.
Well, as you mentioned, you were a very good athlete participating in several sports. But once you started getting into wrestling training, how difficult was it for you to learn the fundamentals of professional wrestling?
Well, it's the fundamentals part. It was just that's a grind. You got to learn how to take the bumps, the falls, because if you don't learn how to take those properly and protect yourself, you'll end up banged up before you even get off the ground, get started. Thank the good Lord, when I walked into the ring, and I'm not trying to brag or say anything, it was like deja vu, like I'd been there before. It was like I was meant to do this, and I was like, so it came fairly easy for me to learn the psychology part and how to do the moves, but the banging and the slamming don't come easy for anyone. You got to get through that rough time. And first of all, the guy that trained us, he got us on our hands and knees, and we didn't get off the mat for like the first 3 months. they even hit the ropes. It was like all amateur style, and we learned from the ground up. And I think that's the best way to teach someone, because one thing you got to know back in those days, they had a thing called kayfabe, you know, where, you know, you didn't expose the business to anyone. And if you did, when you went in the dressing room and they found out about it, you would get all the hell kicked out of you, because that's the way guys made a living, and they protect the business with their life. I mean, I got in many fights in bars and places over people saying the big F word and calling wrestling fake. And so when you were trained, the one thing they trained you back then was to learn how to protect yourself. Because say you go to a territory, when I worked for Bill Watts, I had three different belts at one time. When in Mid-South, I had the Northwest Heavyweight belt, I had the Mississippi Heavyweight belt, and I was one half the tag team champions, right? Bill Watts tells me, if you get your ass whooped, excuse my language, anywhere out here, loud fan, you're automatically fired. I don't care how many belts you got. So that's the way life was, you know. So you better be able to protect yourself. And they actually wouldn't put a belt on a guy that they didn't think could handle it, really. Because if you couldn't protect the belt, they normally would not put one on you. But that's where it was back then.
You tell a great story in the book about, you know, here you are, a young kid in the business, and next thing you know, you're driving Ric Flair around from show to show. What did you learn from riding along with the Nature Boy Ric Flair?
Well, for one thing, everyone, I don't have to tell everyone what a great professional athlete or what a great talent that Ric Flair is. He'll tell you himself, but no, Ric is a great guy. I've always got along with him. You know, I've heard some people say things about him, but you know what? He treated me, and I learned to treat people the way they treat me in this business. And Ric treated me, I always said he was a gentleman and a scholar. The two guys that I say that about in this business, or three actually, is Roddy Piper, Ric Flair, and Ivan Koloff were gentlemen and scholars. They treated me with the utmost respect in the wrestling business. And but Ric Flair came, he lost his driver's license. And he owned a brand new Lincoln and a brand new Cadillac, but he couldn't drive either one. they told him, the office told him, the bosses says, you need to find someone to drive you. So pick one of the young boys here, young guys is working here for the office. And we're working for the Crockett's in Mid-Atlantic Wrestling. So he picked me. Now, for some reason, I didn't know Ric that well at the time, but for some reason he decided he chose me. I don't know. What a gift from God, because I'm riding. They were grooming him for the world title at the time. He hadn't won it yet, and so they were grooming him for it. And so everywhere that we went, he was on fire. Everywhere we went was sold out. So I'm going to a sold out show every night. I'm getting to wrestle on the first or second match, and I'm talking to Flair in the car, and he's critiquing my matches, and he's also critiquing my interviews, because, like he said, 90% of this is your persona, your character on TV. You got to be able to draw and put people in those seats. And just because you can take a big backdrop and you can drop kick and you can do a flip over the top rope, that's fine and dandy. Everyone can do that. But can you get up on TV and you talk people in those arenas to buy a ticket to see you fight? And so you got to be able to rap on that TV. And we used to write things down on yellow pads. We used to put them on a recorder. We used to talk in front of the mirror and practice these things. Believe it or not, Ric Flair does too. Until we got him down, buddy. And he would just drill that in my head. And then one day, all of a sudden, we're at Raleigh TV, and I'm driving along thinking I'm a big shot because I drive Ric Flair and all the other guys don't. And Crockett comes to me and goes, hey, I want you to go on TV today, and you got a 3-minute generic interview to do. Flair said you could talk your ass off. I go, what? I couldn't believe it. So I went out there and I pulled it off, and I wouldn't have been able to if it wasn't been for Ric. And so they started taking a look at me from there. So it wasn't too much long after that, the word got out and I got the break in Mid-South. But thank God for Ric. You know, he helped me tremendously. You can imagine riding with the guy they're grooming for the world title, and you get to study and pick his brain every day and night, you know?
It was
fantastic.
You mentioned in the book how, you know, it's so different nowadays where guys, they just see each other kind of in the airport, flying city to city. You know, you don't get that camaraderie anymore, where you were in the car with them 2, 3, 4 hours at a time. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, I worked for WCW for a while, you know, and it's like you just see guys in the airport flying different directions. It's never you never have that companionship or sitting there, like you're saying, and just talking and going over things, you know, and it makes a big, big difference.
It's very interesting to me when you talk about learning how to tell a story in the ring, because everything's important, from your facial expressions to the moveset to the music, everything. And yet you had a bit of a challenge, because as a famous masked wrestler, you weren't able to tell the same kind of story with your face. What are some of the challenges?
Here's the thing. The reason I started wearing the mask was, so if you see me without the mask, you say, okay, I got my size. I was real small, and I first territory I got fired because I was too small in Amarillo. And then I got up, I gained 50 pounds, and I worked hard in the gym. And so I got the size I needed. So I looked like a pro wrestler. I had the look, and then I could talk good on TV. I practiced with Flair, and I did think, and I could talk well on TV, but I wasn't good looking enough to draw the women out. And I wasn't ugly enough to scare nobody. And so I just had like a plain, Jane, looked like a regular shoe salesman or a book salesman, just an average guy. And so they go, this is not going to draw us any money. But when I put that mask on and I put that boot on, that gimmick, all of a sudden everything changed. Now I could talk, and I had a gimmick to sell to the people, and I had the look as a wrestler. And so that's the difference right there. And you're telling the story to the people. You tell them, like, it starts when you leave the dressing room door. As soon as you leave the door, it starts from there. All you got to think, you got to get to the ring and you start telling the story. It starts from that first step out of that dressing room. You start portraying what you're going to sell those people, and you build it from there to the bell ring until you get back to the dressing room. But that's what made – and the thing with the mask, the hardship about that is you have no facial expressions. You can't – if you're in pain, they can't see your face. If you're happy, they can't see your face. If you – being mean, they can't see it, that you got a scowl on your face. So you have to use body language. And so I learned to really sell stuff with my body language. And you have to do that to wear a mask and be successful at it.
My favorite quote in the entire book's on page 18, where your trainer says to you, kid, wrestling is a big man's sport. I can make you wider, and I can make you thicker, but I can't make you taller. I'll take your money and I'll train you, but you will never make a dime in this business, unquote. Well, first of all, you proved him wrong. And also, was that a sentiment, you know, as a 5'10" wrestler that you carried with you as a motivation for the rest of your career?
It did. You know, excuse me. Yeah. When he said that, that's the reason I wasn't sure I wanted. I was sitting with my dad across the desk from the guy, and I had tried to get Tiger Conway Senior trained me, and he refused. And I tried to get into, they had some lucha type wrestling there in Houston. And I went over there, and those guys, I was there a couple of weeks, and they weren't, that wasn't the proper type training. So I was just having a hard time trying to get in, like a lot of guys do. There was just a closed door trying to get into this business. And then I come along, and this guy tells me that. And when he said that, just, I'm looking at him, I go, you know what, I'm going to make it in this if it kills me. Just something inside me went, you know what, and for the rest of my – and here's – I'll tell you one thing that's not in there that Ernie Ladd used to say. And Ernie Ladd was booking for Bill Watts in Mid-South whenever the Freebirds were there. And it was first Buck Robley, then Ernie Ladd took the book. And things were still rolling. We were still just selling places out. And that's when Junkyard Dog was on top and all these big stars, Orndorff, you name it, was there, right? And the guys sometimes would say that in the dressing room, you know, like, yeah, you midget, you know, stuff like that. Because you got big guys, you know, in the dressing room. And Ernie Ladd used to go like this. Now, Ernie Ladd was 6'10", okay?
Yeah.
And he'd go, let me tell you boys something. Y'all might make fun of the grappler and say he's a midget, but when he puts that loaded boot on and goes to the ring, he's 6 foot in any man's world. And so that always made me feel really good. I loved Ernie Ladd for saying that, and I always kept that in my back of my mind, because that 5'10" thing, you can't make it, you never will, I proved them all wrong on that one.
I thought one of the most interesting parts of the book is when you talk about Junkyard Dog being on top, and his matches were 5 minutes long. He could not work a long match, and yet you were on the card and expected to go 60 minutes, you know, put in a long match, and it really reinforced how everybody plays a part in the entire story of the evening. However, my question for you is, even though JYD was bringing big crowds and everyone's making money, was there some resentment in the locker room, not just from yourself, but from others, that, man, he's going out there and only putting in 5 minutes?
Well, you know, it's the way we were drawing houses and the money people were making, they weren't really, like, everybody, I tell you what, Junkyard Dog, honestly, was such a nice guy and a good-natured fella. You couldn't hardly get mad at him. You know what I mean? Even though if he was going 2 minutes, you go, you know, that's Dog. But look how many people he's bringing to the building, you know? But really, I mean, if there had been some guy who had a cocky attitude about it, somebody that was a show-off or a showboat, there might have been that kind of animosity against him. But with Dog, he's just the type of person. It was very hard to get mad at him. And I never resented him, or I don't think the guys ever did. Of course, sometimes I would say, one time, you know, in the Superdome, I remember he got paid more money than me, and I worked with him, and I called the whole match, and I go, I asked Watts, what the hell? I go, I had called everything, and I made him like $1 million, and then you pay him more money than I get. And so he said, hey, yeah, because he put the asses in the seat, and you didn't. Which was not totally true. We both kind of did, but I guess they wouldn't have came if Junkyard Dog wouldn't have been there to fight me, you know? So I wasn't much I could say, but, you know, sometimes you felt like, wait a minute, I got jerked a little bit here. But as far as Dog resentment, no, because he was such a sweetheart of a guy. I mean, you just couldn't, I don't know, I didn't really see anybody get mad at him.
Well, the crazy thing about Junkyard Dog in that time in Mid-South, you talk about a sweetheart of a guy. The crowds were not very friendly, though, right? You tell an amazing story.
Oh, no.
You almost got shot because you were beating up JYD. Tell us a little bit about the mood and the feel of wrestling down south at that time.
Well, see, like, he was like their savior. Here's Junkyard Dog. He's the one black hope, okay, in the locker room. And he comes out, and he's the main event, and he kicks everybody's butt. So, man, those people are behind him, right? So the night you're talking about, when I come out in New Orleans, it's like it must have been 90% African-Americans out there, okay? And it's packed. And so when I got to the ring, I'm standing in the ring. Now, I don't know who started this. I said Junkyard Dog. Yeah, that's the first time I ever heard it. They might have been doing this before. I know that the New Orleans Saints do this now. But the first time I ever heard this, when the fans are doing this, who they say is going to beat that dog? Who that? Who that? Now, I don't know if the Saints stole that from him or he stole it from them. But all I know is a long time ago they were doing that for Junkyard Dog. And so they were all doing this. And then that's when I told the referee, here comes Dog to the ring, and he's got that chain, that collar around his neck with that big chain. I said, I told him, tell Dog I'm going to jump him when he comes through the ropes. And when I did, all heck broke loose. The guy ringside pulls a .357 Magnum out. The cops have to take him down. I had my back to him. I didn't even see it. I didn't know till the match was over. But, man, the police officer tells me after it's over, you need to go shake the officer's hand. I go, why? Because he just saved your life out there. I said, why? And he comes and tells me, yeah, he pulled a .357 Magnum. If he would have shot you at that range, there's no way you would have made it. But, yeah, they took wrestling very seriously when you wrestled Junkyard Dog. In Mississippi, I remember there was a guy a couple of times we had to have thrown out because he'd pull his knife out at ringside. And just, you know, you could tell he was sipping that whiskey a little bit too. So by the time Dog come out there, he was fired up, you know. So you had to watch your back with him too. But, yeah, got kind of hairy sometimes down south with those fans.
Well, you were at the time anyway, the longest reigning Mid-South North American champion. And when I was a kid growing up, Len, titles were very important to me. I wanted my favorite wrestlers to be champions. I didn't realize at the time how championship belts were kind of props and storytelling devices. As a performer, how important were titles to you when you were wrestling?
Well, the one thing about if you had a title, say like the North American heavyweight title, do you know that you were figured in for a while to stay? Mm. So it's like, okay, they're not going to tell me goodbye in a month, you know, unless something really goes bad here. And so if they gave you a belt, they planned on you being there for a while because they figured you as their champion, you know? And so that was one thing. It was a little bit of security. But a lot of times, some of the best wrestlers they have in the area, a lot of different – it depends on the area. But a lot of times, some of the best wrestlers they have don't have a championship belt because they don't need that to build their reputation up. They're that good of a wrestler.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like they can do it with a, with, say, Junkyard Dog could do it with a gimmick. He didn't have to have a belt. He was the Junkyard Dog. Kamala could do it with his gimmick. He didn't need a belt. So it depends on the person. In my case, my whole persona was a wrestler. Okay, so it made sense for me to have a championship belt, you know, if I was any good at all. Because that's all I promoted when I was up there. I'm the grappler. I'm the best wrestler in wrestling today. It says on the top of the marquee, professional wrestling. That's what we're selling to you people. That's what I'm bringing to you people, and I'm the best at it. You know, they got a name for you when you're the greatest wrestler in wrestling today. They don't call you a great wrestler. They call you the grappler. Beat me if you can. That was my whole drive. So it added up. It made sense for me to have a championship belt in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, the book, again, is called Grappler, Memoirs of a Masked Madman. And I want to move on, Len. You have some great other stories in there, by the way, of your time in Mid-South, working with Ted DiBiase, Ox Baker,
yeah.
Of course. The famous story with Jake Roberts where you, quote-unquote, helped create the DDT. People have to go read that. It's fantastic. You tell about the night you beat both Andre and Dusty Rhodes, which is, I mean, a remarkable story. But,
yeah, that amazed me, too.
but then you found yourself with a lot of success, but then you found yourself just as quickly at the bottom or middle of the card making less money. Talk a little bit about how frustrating it can be as a professional wrestler to, quote-unquote, lose your spot.
Yeah, it was like, well, I tell you what did it, okay? And I learned a very hard lesson about ego right there. Because it was, what happened? I wrestled in the Superdome. It was the match with, I believe it was Junkyard Dog, and where he got paid more than me, and I got upset about it. And I went to Watts, and I went, hey, you know, this ain't right. I mean, I took all the bumps. I took all the beating, all the bruises. Got to this spot in the Superdome. I go out there, it's time for the payday, and he gets double what I get, and I'm calling the whole match. And now, you mind you, I was only 21 years old, okay? and I had the North American Heavyweight title, but I thought I was, like, with my ego, I thought I was Harley Race or something, you know? But I learned real quick that I wasn't. And so I told Bill, if you can't do better than this, I need to get out of here, you know? And he's like, oh, really? Now, of course, Bill Watts knew promoters all over the country, okay? That's what he did for a living. And so he comes to me and says, well, if you want to go, he said, this is like a week later, you want to go, I talked to Ole Anderson in Charlotte, and they have the Young Bloods over there, you know, and he said, they got the World Tag Team Championship. He said, and that's when me and Super Destroyer were tagging up as partners. And he said, they want to bring you guys over there and do something with the Young Bloods. And I said, yeah, well, I'm ready to go. I'll give you my 2 weeks notice. Go ahead and get me booked there. And so Bill goes, fine. And so he sent me there. But the whole thing was to teach me a lesson. I got there. Now, I was averaging $3,000 a week at 21 years old, okay?
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I don't know why I was complaining about money, but I had a house paid for, a brand new Lincoln paid for, and a brand new pickup paid for, okay, and money in the bank. And I was making $3,000 a week, and I'm 21. And so with my ego, I think I should be making more, right? So I go. So I probably deserved what I got here. But I, you know, I went and Watts got me booked over there and went there. And, like, I would say within 6 weeks later, I drove 3,000 miles, and my check was $300 for the week.
Ugh.
Okay. Yeah, $300. I went into Ole and I said, Ole, I can't feed my family on this. He goes, well, let them starve. And man, I started to come across a desk. He goes, hey, you can jump up and start fighting and do anything you want to, but you're still going to get $300. And that's what that's the lesson you get for being a dumbass. He goes, now take your ego and put it in your back pocket and learn about this business before you open your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you can thank Bill Watts for that lesson, and me too. And I was like, just, I didn't know what to say. I was just shocked. And so I gave my notice there and went on. It took me about 5 years to ever get back to make the kind of money that was like that again. Because once the word gets out, oh, he's got a big head, he's got this and that. It took a while before I got past that image and got onto where I could get some breaks and make some good money. But it was tough. It was a tough one. And Dusty Rhodes tried to tell me. I rode with Dusty the night before I gave him my notice, and he goes, He says, baby, let me talk to you. We're coming from some show in Texas. And he goes, baby, listen, grandpa, baby. How old are you, man? I said, you're 21 years old. You're making $3,000 a week. He said, you got any friends, 21, that make $3,000 a week? I go, no. He goes, me either. He said, I think I'd be quiet and just take the check. I said, no, man, that ain't right. It's not right. I should be paid for what I'm doing, just like everybody else. Anyway, just a kid with a big ego, but I learned a heavy lesson. And then, but it was hard. It was a hard one, but I fought my way back from there. But I'll never forget that lesson. I always thought before I opened my mouth the next time about any money.
Well, in the book, you know, you of course talk about your journey through the Indies, working in Portland, moving on into St. Louis, and man, what personalities you did come across. Talk about Bill Watts, talk about Ole Anderson, you know, talk about Harley Race in St. Louis, Jerry Lawler, you know, the Road Warriors, on and on. Of course, Billy Jack Haynes up in Oregon, and what it always said, like when I was reading the stories, how complicated this business is. It's about drawing money, but it's a very, very tough business. And you really survived, didn't you, Len, getting through those territories?
Yeah, it's right. You have to deal with the personalities. Like when I came here to work for Don Owens, I was in Texas working for the Von Erichs. And so I had done my run there. It was time to go. And so I got booked. Actually, Rip Oliver helped me get booked here. He got booked for Vince in WWE. And yep. So he told Don that I would be, you know, a good candidate to take over the book here. To run the territory for him. So I came in and finally me and Don got it squared up on the phone with about how much money, which I should be making. And so I came here and this whole place is like, now you come over and you take this job as the boss and you're going to run it. Now you have to prove that you can draw money. See that my days from just wrestling and taking my boots and my tights and stuff and my bag and going in and putting my gear on. So I'm the grappler. Now I'm going to get on TV and do interviews for you. And I'm going to go out and wrestle matches and I'm going to draw houses. We're over. Now, probably around 25, the first time I booked for Harley Race and was in Kansas City. And after that, everywhere I went, they hired me as a booker. And so a main event wrestler as well as their booker. And so that means you run the whole territory and all the guys and you create all the storylines. And that is a big task. That's what I've done since then. I do right now for West Coast Wrestling Connection here in Portland. I write TVs and I help set up all the situations with the wrestlers, all the storylines and all the things we do. But then it turns into a whole different world. Now you got to handle everybody's personality and their egos. And that's where it really starts to get fun because everybody in pro wrestling's got an ego. Okay, everybody wants to have the belt, and everybody wants to make the most money, and everybody wants to win. And so, and everybody can't just win, okay, and have the belts and all the money. So it's a heck of a task doing that. But that's what I've been doing for a long time now.
That's interesting. I thought some of the stories about Harley Race in the book are just fantastic. When Vince was going national and how Harley dug his heel in. I mean, you tell some great stories about Rick Rude. And of course, I didn't know these stories, and I liked them when they got to WWF at the time. And, here, you know, filling in some of the pieces of history was great. I wanted to ask you, when you became the booker, and you were in charge of the book in Portland, how important was your experience as an individual singles wrestler, but also as a very, very accomplished tag team wrestler, to understand how to tell both kinds of stories?
No, it's very important because that's like I'm saying, you're dealing with every different personality. So you've got say 12 guys on this side, on the heel side, and 12 guys on the babyface side, the good guy side, and you gotta see what's gonna touch these people's emotions and draw the most people to the arena. And then of course all these guys think they can draw better than the other. And so you have to separate them, their egos, and put all it together and make it draw money. And now Don Owens is going, listen, if you don't draw, you're fired. He would let you know that real quick. And so because you came here, I'm paying you a guarantee a week. If you don't get this place drawing more money than we're making right now, then you're history. I'll find somebody else. And so you always got that thing on your back. But thank the good Lord, I've been very fortunate and lucky enough to everywhere I've been, I've done well and drew money for people. But yeah, it's a constant battle to keep the personalities and all the things clicking and together. You know, I mean, I've had guys come in and we start putting an angle behind them and get them pushing, they get hurt, or you get them going and all of a sudden they quit and just decide to quit and go somewhere else. And leave you in the middle of stuff. So you have to work around all kinds of different things. But after working so many years now, I've seen just about everything you could almost throw at me, you know.
I believe that. In fact, one of the, for me, best parts of your book, Grappler, Memoirs of a Masked Madman, Len, was that you were very honest in this book. When you talk about working in WCCW, you talked about some of the changes once the Oregon Wrestling Commission implemented rules about drug testing. You were very honest about some of the troubles in the locker rooms at the time.
Oh, yeah.
The problems the Von Erichs were having. And I thought if you would not have included that side of the business, there would have been a big hole in your book. But you didn't.
Yeah.
You were very honest about the business. And I think that the readers will really appreciate that you were.
Yeah, well, I'm glad. It's like, there's, you know, it's the thing was, a lot of people ask me this nowadays. They go, you know, are you, because like when I broke in 77, you know, like I said, it was like a locked-in business. It was hard to get into. And then once you got into it, it's kayfabe all the way. It's like, you know, you protected the business. And then when Vince come along and they said, okay, this is all, it's wrestling entertainment. This is all entertainment. And he exposed the business to everyone. Everybody, I get this question a lot. They go, do you think it was a good thing or you think it was a bad thing? And if, after thinking about it, you know, I think that it was a good thing because it opened up so many different venues for guys to make money in different areas where before they would be quiet and they wouldn't say anything because if they went in the dressing room and they were out on TV or something talking about this, they would get the heck kicked out of them. And so, but this opened up. It didn't. I don't think it hurt the business at all. It expanded it, made it more of a moneymaker, and opened up a lot of venues and things for guys to make money that we possibly could never do before.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that's why when I was in the book, I just told exactly where it was, as far as the commission and as far as the drugs and the stuff like that. I mean, it's like any professional sport. It's not just wrestling. Athletes do everything that anybody else does, and it's like when they get to that level, and you're going to have your ones that abuse it and ones that don't, you know, so it's no sense in trying to hide that from people.
I thought it was just a page-turning part of the book. You have a fascinating career. You were on top. You kind of fell down to the middle of the card, came back on top as a promoter and a booker in Portland. You had the belt there for a while. But you then talk about going into what you called a carpenter status, where you were supposed to work with younger wrestlers to help them learn the business, one being Jim Hellwig, who then became the Ultimate Warrior. What are some of your memories of working with Jim and maybe a thought or two as he unfortunately passed in April?
Well, Jim, I thank God he gave me the plug when he was on the Hall of Fame. Thank God. And I couldn't believe the next day I hear he passes. I could not believe it. You know, God bless the poor guy.
Okay.
What happened with him, I was in Texas, you know, working for Von Erich. And so he's in there. They call him the Dingo Warrior. It wasn't the Ultimate Warrior at that time. And so he was just getting it started. And he had this huge body. Well, nobody wanted to work with him because every time he could lock up with you and hurt you. It's like, holy cow, he's so green. Yeah. So, of course, who did they give to wrestle him? Me, right? I go, thanks a lot, guys. They say, but the problem was they wanted him to learn how to do a press slam. That's where the press slam thing come in. And they said, they said, well, can you teach us? Yeah, I can teach him how. And because I've done it with Junkyard Dog, you name it, everybody, Tony Atlas, Orndorff, just on and on and on, Snuka, they all did the press slam at one time. And so I said, okay, yeah. So they booked me around the loop with him for 2 weeks, and every night he'd do the press slam. I'll tell you something, man. He just about killed me, but he finally got it down, you know, where he could once he learned how to do it, that it takes two and it's a coordinated effort. He learned how to just zip me right up there like it was like a feather. But
mm-hmm.
It's like he just could not get that at first. And finally he got it once it clicked on him. But what was a classic thing to me with him is when he went to he was working for Vince, you know, in WWE when they had the world title, right? I guess he won the world title from Hogan. And he was in the dressing room in Houston. I went to Houston to visit John Nord, which is a real good friend of mine. He was working as a berserker at the time. So he sent me one of his frequent flyer tickets to come down there to Houston because my folks, that's where I'm from. My folks are all over. He said, come down here, but you got to party with me one night, and then you can go do whatever you want to. I go, no problem. Like, he had to twist my arm for that. I go to Houston, and I'm in the dressing room. It was at the Summit at the time. I don't think they even wrestle the Summit anymore, but it was where the basketball team there, the Rockets, used to play. And so right. I'm walking in the back, and all of a sudden I see him, Jimmy. He goes, hey, he's always at the door. And the dressing room door, and I see him just come in here and start coming in, shut the door. He goes, hey, Jim, how you doing, man? I didn't even know it was on the card. I just went there to see Nord. And he said, how you doing? He goes, hey, shut the door a minute. So I shut it. He goes, I want to talk to you. He goes, hey, Lenny. He goes, and there's catered food in the dressing room. He's got everything. He goes, you know, brother, they give me the world title. I come from the airport back and forth in a limo every night. He goes, I fly first class everywhere I go. I have catered. I tell him I want chicken breast. And I tell him what my diet is because, I'm a bodybuilder. And they have a perfect diet, whatever I want, whatever vegetables, whatever I want. I want protein shakes. I want this. I want that. It's catered for me. They treat you first class. But he said, you know what? I'm quitting this damn place. And I go, what are you doing that for? He goes, because they ripped me off. Now, this goes back to Lynn Benton and the Superdome with Junkyard Dog. Mm-hmm. Okay, the ego again. I said, why are you quitting, Jim? He goes, well, you know that last WrestleMania? I said, yeah, I heard about it. He goes, well, they gave damn Hogan $1 million payoff, and they only gave me $500,000. I go, what? Yeah, I said, what? He says it again. I go, let me ask you something, Jim. I said, when we were learning how to do the press slam, okay, in Dallas for 2 weeks around the loop, beating the hell out of each other, how much will we get paid a match? He goes, $75 a night. I go, yeah. And I said, and you're pitching about $500,000 for a 20-minute match? I said, are you kidding me? He goes, this don't matter. It just ain't right. I did just as much, just like I was thinking about Dog. I could not change his mind. And you know, the man went and quit on a $500,000 payoff.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it, man. And I said, I did the same thing years ago. Wasn't quite as much money, but it's like unbelievable, the ego. Yeah.
That's an amazing story.
Yeah, that's unreal. I couldn't believe it.
Let's go back. Before you left to go to Portland later in your career, you met a young lady who had two daughters, and they became very special to you. Then, of course, you ended up marrying her. She became your wife later on.
Right.
Discuss the difficulties in professional wrestling of balancing work and family.
Well, it gets like this. You're on the road. Luckily, here in Portland, we came home usually every night. Sometimes you have to stay over. Some of the territories, you're on the road, and you stay over two or three nights a week, four, and you come home 2 days. That gets really hard, especially with a family. And then it gets to the point that you're on TV every Saturday, and they see you, so they know you all over town. So everywhere you go, it's, hey, grappler, and the family's like, they get so tired of that. It's like, can we just have a normal life and not – I mean, what is, you know, do you have to be a star everywhere we go? It's like, whether you want to or not, that's what you're doing. So it's brought upon you. You know, that's your life. That's the way you make a living. So you can't avoid it. You want to try to, you actually want to promote it because the bigger you are, the more money you make. And sure. So it's like a double-edged sword because your family wants you to be daddy and your career wants you to be the grappler or the biggest star you can be. And so it's hard to work in between and you have a lot of problems, but luckily my family's handled it pretty well. My girls are grown now, and so and then since I met Katie, I've been wrestling from day one, so she knows that's what I was doing from the get-go, so kind of accepted it, you know.
Right, right.
But it's not easy on anybody with a family.
No, again, an interesting part of the book there when you discuss some of those challenges. And then when you got settled in Oregon, then, you know, she moved up there with the girls and you created a life there. For people that haven't read the book yet, the ending to your story, at least in the book, going through where Michael PSA has offered you a job at WWE, but the timing wasn't right in 95. You had a WCW tryout match and kind of offered a 2-year deal with WCW that fell apart, sort of, but they gave you the silent treatment, and then you were in that match with Goldberg on Nitro. I'm telling you, I don't want to go too much into it now because I want people to buy the book, but those are just fascinating stories about a red-hot time in this business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just the thing there was I got back in shape and I was ready to get that run in WCW, but Scott Norton is a good friend of mine, and I helped him here in Portland, and then he got his break in Japan, and he got a break in WCW as well as Crush, and he has been talking to Bischoff, and they brought me in, and he said he came to me and said, Lenny, I talked to Bischoff. The contract's getting written up now. You got a deal. It's going down. And that was 2 weeks before I wrestled Goldberg. And so I thought it was all set. And then all of a sudden everything reversed. I don't know what happened or who got to who, but you know, this is a funny business and this I'll probably never know. But, all of a sudden it was, I wrestled Goldberg. When I seen he beat me on national TV, I figured, well, they want that contract. And then the next booking I got from them was down at the, was in Orlando at the studios there at Universal Studios, mm-hmm. and that where they do all the television tapings. And so I was on all these matches from here to hell, all over the place. And so I went, this ain't looking very good. So I just told him, I said, look, you know, I had a business, a thriving business, it's a transmission yep. shop here, me and Roddy Piper. And I said, I got to get back to work and take care of my family, or y'all got to do something or get off the pot, make a decision. And I never see another booking sheet after that. So wow. I guess they decided not to have me.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Roddy Piper. I saved him to the end, Len, here because, you know, he writes the foreword in your book here. And yes. he is a critical central figure in your story through professional wrestling and then going into business with him after you basically essentially retired as a full-time wrestler. What is it yes. about Roddy Piper that makes him such a wonderful friend and a special part of your life?
Well, you know, I met Roddy when I was in Charlotte. I guess I was 18 years old or so. And through the business, I've known him for since then, you know, and we've been in different places together. And we booked together here for Don Owens in Portland. And that was when I was on the last run of this territory here. And when Vince put Don Owens out of business for good. Mm-hmm. And then I was headed back to Texas, you know, and I was going to was going back home for a little break, and I was going to see if I could get booked in WWE myself, and I figured I'd probably get a shot at it. And that's when Roddy goes, you know, I want to open a business here in town. And that's how we end up getting the shop together, because I really didn't want to leave because my girls were in school. They're older now, and they kind of had a lot of friends here. And so I just hung around. I did that, give it a try, and it worked out. Thank God. I can't believe I made that go. that was a shot in the dark. I called my dad, believe it or not, my father was still alive at the time. And he goes, I said, you know, I'm going to stay here. I'm going to open a transmission shop. And he goes, you're going to do what? I said, I'm going to open a transmission shop. He goes, well, why don't you just open up a business building space shuttles? Because you know just about as much about those as you do transmissions. I said, thanks for all the confidence, Dad. But anyway, I made it go anyway. Somehow, and we ended up making some money out of it in the end. We sold it now, the property and all, but we did okay with it. But Roddy was always seemed like we crossed paths in different territories, and he was the type of guy who would he'd give you a hand if you could, if you had needed him at all. He was always there, and even after that, I went and worked for Roddy. You know, he's an entertainer, not just in wrestling. He does some movies and he does things over in England and different places. And I traveled with him, you know, and worked with him for like almost 3 years after that. And we've done so much stuff together. It's unreal, me and Rod. You know, he's got a stand-up act he does now, and I helped him with that some, and just all kinds of things. He's just he is an entertainer, my friend. He's a consummate professional, I'll tell you that. And
I just
want to
hear, yeah, a little bit more about him. I mean, you know, we see so much of him on television and, of course, his career in the ring. And this humanized him a little bit for me. Is that fair?
Yeah. You know, Roddy's a family person, a good person. And if he's got your back, brother, I could call him right now no matter where he's at, and I guarantee he'd be there for me. He's the type of guy you always know be there for you. And that's, I mean, you can't ask for a better friend than that, you know?
Well, what do you still want to do in the business, Len? You're currently working with West Coast Wrestling Connection, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm with the West Coast Wrestling Connection. We do a show the first Saturday of every month here, like September 6th, we got a show at the Bob White Theater here on Foster Street. And then on Sunday, we do Salem the next day. That's once a month. And then we have a show. I do a show in, it's called Wrestling from Hollywood, out in L.A. We do that show. And it airs on MAV TV. Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to do here is the guy I'm working for, the promoter that lives in Salem, runs the show for WCWC. I'm trying to get that thing developed. It's just a local TV right now that shows in Portland area, most of Oregon and a little bit of Washington. But we wanted to try to get this show drawing and get it, you know, some good sponsors behind it, get it taking care of itself. And we have a training school as well, the Grapplers Wrestling Academy, where I train people, and that's in Salem. Okay. And so we got a lot of good things going. We can build some wrestlers and stay in it and keep the TV going so they have an outlet to be trained at, and then they can show their wares on TV if they're good enough. And from there, hopefully get picked up by events or somewhere, or get booked in different places around the country. A lot of the independents are starting to pick up now, so it looks like they're getting more places and venues and places to work around. Like, I'm booked in Texas in September the 28th. I'm in Fort Worth. There's a show there. And so I'm working there, and I guess they're going to have Cornette's going to be there, and Larry Hansen's going to be there, and Black Bart's going to be there. So a bunch of old-timers are on that show as well. And so,
well, in fact, I'm a board member of the Cauliflower Alley Club. I believe you as well are a CAC member, right?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
A lot of CAC folks are going to be down there. Morgan Dollar and a few others down there that show as well.
Oh, are they? Okay, fantastic. That's great. All right. Looking forward to that show.
Excellent. Well, will you be in Las Vegas next April for the CAC 50th anniversary?
Oh, I'm pretty sure I will. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I will be there. Yeah. I plan on it.
Well, I'd certainly like to meet you in person, and I want to congratulate you on really a wonderful book, Grappler, Memoirs of a Masked Madman. It's a tremendous read, available now on Amazon or at your website. You said grapplerbook.com. Before
yes,
we let you go, where else can people find you on social media? You mentioned some of your websites. You have a Twitter, a Facebook page, anything in social media?
Yeah, the Facebook page, go on there and see me anytime on the Facebook page. And they can look on just look up West Coast Wrestling Connection. I'm all over that as well. And
okay.
So, yeah. And like you said, grapplerbook.com if they want the book. And I hope people enjoy it. I've got some great reviews, and thank God. Thank everyone for the great reviews. I want to thank everybody out there for that. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, I highly recommend it. Len, congratulations on a wonderful book, and thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Hey, Dave, thanks a million for having me, buddy. I appreciate it.
Have a great rest of the day.
You too, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye. Don't forget to check out the OWW website at onlineworldofwrestling.com for the latest news, analysis, and updates from the world of professional wrestling. While you're there, you can also catch up on past episodes of OWW Radio. You can email us at radio@onlineworldofwrestling.com to submit topics or questions you would like us to discuss on an upcoming broadcast. Also, make sure to follow us on Twitter at OWWCOM to get all program updates and announcements. We'll also be posting directly to the official OWW Facebook home page. Till next time, I am David. Thanks again to the Grappler, Len Denton, for today's interview. Pick up a copy of his book, Grappler, Memoirs of a Masked Madman. It is a great read, a lot of great stories we didn't have time to talk about today. I really think you'll enjoy the book, and I certainly hope you enjoyed the interview today. We'll be back soon with another edition of OWW Radio. All right, well, that's